This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is brought to you by two of our sponsors. One is the International Brotherhood of Magicians Annual Convention 2024 that'll take place in Tacoma, Washington on July the 10th through the 13th. Be sure to go to ibmconvention.com and there you can find more information about that to sign up and register today. It promises to be a really great convention up in the northwest of the United States. Also, I want to thank Dr. Bruce Lish for helping to support the podcast with your donation. And also want to wish you a very happy birthday. I understand that, Bruce, today is your 55th birthday, and this has come to be an annual tradition in which that we give you a shout-out for your birthday. This year, it's going to be a little bit different than what we have done in past years, and I think you'll enjoy this. If you'll just hang around until the end of this podcast, I have something very special to give you as a birthday shout-out. Well, this week we're going to go over to England where we get to visit with Paul Gordon. He was recently on the cover of the Linking Ring magazine. He has also done lectures for Murphy's Magic at the Table and done things for Penguin and has been on the cover of the Magic Circular and other kinds of things. Basically, he has done it all. He specializes in card magic and is one of the foremost proponents of card magic in the world. He is very prolific in the things that he has created. He is in his 60s now, and so he has had several decades of experience, and so he's going to share some of those things with us here this week. And I know you're going to enjoy learning from him, but also perhaps equally or more importantly, you'll enjoy the stories. We really get into a lot of jokes and funny stories and things I think that you'll enjoy then as well. One of the things that I did not know about him, but apparently is very much an important part of his life, and that is that he is a crooner. He sings the classics from Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett and you name it. He has a full orchestra behind him, and this is something that he almost went into as a full-time profession, but then kind of took the side route. Instead of being a crooner, became a conjurer. So I'm going to let you listen to what he has to say rather than me telling you about all of this. I'll let it unfold as you listen. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Paul Gordon, here on The Magic Word. Well, today we go again across the pond. We do this from time to time, and I wish I could go over there more often on a personal basis like we did in Blackpool here recently this year, but this is the easiest way of trying to do it via Zoom. So this week I got a chance to visit with someone here that I know you're going to be enjoying, someone who is a creator. He's a performer, a writer, a publisher. He's got a lot of DVDs out. He's probably one of the more prolific magicians I know of, and very adept card magician and in every aspect of it. And we're going to get into that. I admire his skills and the things that he has done and accomplished and contributed to our art to advance it with the different things that he has created. And we'll talk about some of those creations and how he comes about that and his muse and all those kinds of things then too. So please welcome my friend all the way over from England. Here he is, Paul Gordon. Hey there, Paul.
Hello, Scott, and thank you very much for asking me to be with you. It's much appreciated.
Well, you're welcome. I'm so glad to get a chance to chat with you. I think the last time might have been when we were at the 4F convention, in which I think you were lecturing that year, at the 2008 or something, and so it's been a few years.
That's right, 2008, when Boris Wilde was...
guest of honor.
And I lectured and I performed in the one of the shows, and I sang as well.
Why could I not remember that? That should have been something that would have been paramount up there. Was that one of the evening show when, when Daryl Rose had hosted the evening show and it was an all English show?
No, it was, no. It was during my performance. I can't remember the schedule now, but it was during the performance. I did a card routine which involved singing a Frank Sinatra song. So I sang the song because I'm also a big band singer. So that's my other racket.
No kidding. So is that kind of what you do when you're not doing magic, like at night, that you're actually kind of out moonlighting and blue lighting?
Well, I've been doing I've been doing the big band singing for 35 years. You know, it's a long time. And originally that was going to be hopefully my career when I was younger, but the magic took off in a bigger way, and so I do the singing when I can, and fitting the magic, and you know, juggling lots of balls in the air, you know.
I find that very fascinating. Whenever that you're singing, I assume that it sounds like you're talking about Frank Sinatra. So do you perform the classics mainly?
Yeah, I do the classics. Yeah, I'm a big Sinatra. I saw Frank Sinatra 18 times in concert over the years.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, big fan. I've been I'm a massive, you know, in the fraternity of Sinatra collectors, I'm one of the big collectors. Hmm. I've got a massive collection of his stuff. And the band is a 20-piece big band. It's not a small band. It's a big band, proper big meaty sound, you know. And if you've got time, anybody, if you want to go to YouTube and type in Paul Gordon singer, you can see me doing my thing.
Wow. So these are more than just clubs because of the size of the band. You're actually going to be like in a proper theater.
Probably, yeah, proper theater work. Well, we have, you know, when many years ago, there used to be a club in our neighborhood which could just about hold the band and just about hold 100 people plus the bar. Everybody was literally shoulder to shoulder, including the musicians. So the trumpeters used to be kind of crammed in like this. It was good days, though. It was a great learning curve for performing close-up as well, learning how to deal with, you know, mainly drunks, really, I guess, you know, right. Drunks in pubs and clubs.
And when you sing, do you sing as a tribute to someone? In other words, do you try to sing in that same style, or is it just you singing the songs?
It's just me singing the song. I don't do an impersonation or anything.
That's what I mean.
It's just the songs and the arrangements. I mean, you know, when you sing to original arrangements, obviously there's a comparison with Frank Sinatra or whoever it may be because of the actual arrangements that everybody recognizes, but I don't do an impersonation.
Right. Now, the people obviously... Well, I don't know, obviously. I guess your backup band knows you're a magician then also?
Yes, yeah. And, you know, again, when I was younger, I used to do the magic and the singing on the same nights on some occasions. So I'd do like 2 hours of close-up around the tables and then 2 hours with the band. But because I'm a very chatty, energetic close-up magician, by the time I got on stage to sing with the band, my voice was halfway gone. So... I stopped doing that as I approached my 40s.
Yeah. And is that
now in my 60s?
Is that now what you prefer, though, is close-up strolling?
I actually retired from gigging during COVID because I thought I'd done 40 years of table hopping and pubs and restaurants and clubs and this, that, and the other, which I thought was long enough for anybody. Thankfully, financially, I didn't need to carry on doing that. So I said to my wife, we've got grandchildren. I'd like to carry on writing and creating and lecturing.
Right.
And that kind of thing. But I don't do the gigs anymore.
And it's interesting you mentioned COVID because I was just having a conversation with a gentleman in Canada just yesterday, unrelated to this podcast and talking about something else. And he was lamenting how that in Canada in particular, among other magicians and performers, particularly variety entertainers, are not coming back the way they are in the United States, specifically in the U.S. post-COVID. It seems like that we've been stretched like in a slingshot for so long, and finally it was let go and everything was, you know, just shot. Everybody wanted to come and see entertainment, and they were willing to pay because they had money that had been kept for a while. So I've heard magicians here in the U.S. say that they are making more post-COVID than they were pre-COVID. Well, this gentleman I was speaking to was lamenting about how it's complete exact opposite in his experience and having difficulty in trying to get people to contact him or call him back when he's had shows he has proven for these companies beforehand, and now he can't get them to even return. I mean, they booked him before, but they won't even return his calls now, it seems, just because it's a post-COVID thing. And I don't, is that something, but in England, I mean, I found that unusual in Canada, since it's just across the border, so close to the U.S., but is it similar as far as post and pre-COVID, or what is it? Has it rebounded very well in the U.K., is my question, I guess, entertainment in general?
Well, I don't think, I think there's a problem because I think the big money has gone, you know, I mean, proper big money, but of course, there's always people who say I'm so busy, you know, I've got gigs coming out my ears and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of people kind of will say that because they don't want to sound like they're not doing so well.
True.
And then I know, because I used to run an agency, that some people are doing gigs for ridiculously low money. I don't know if it's just to pay the bills or to keep busy, but you know, somebody who I know very, very well said that they did a gig fairly recently for the equivalent of, $90, you know. Which is just can't even pay the gas money, whatever you call it.
To get
America.
There, right.
And, wow. And of course, you know, you've also got, in this country, you pay 20% goes to the Inland Revenue tax man.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the halcyon days to me seem, and I spoke to lots of professional colleagues, the halcyon days of gigging over here was probably 80s, 90s, up until the 2008 recession. I think things went downhill a bit after 2008. But certainly after COVID, I mean, the whole world seems different, doesn't it? Everything seems different. It's
well, very true. And that was my other question, having to do with a world shift in events. And that is when we had 9/11 with the Twin Towers situation back in 2001. It affected entertainment directly and immediately. And companies were not paying for any kind of entertainment. They were cutting back. Was it similar in the UK, even though that you're a completely different country across a wide Atlantic? Yeah.
Well, it changed a big deal in 2001 because I think mainly because I used to travel a lot worldwide doing shows.
Mm-hmm.
And so the travel industry had struggled, hadn't it, after 2000?
Yeah.
Because people weren't flying because they were fearful of flying.
Right.
And travel and so on. And the complete mayhem of getting on a plane at the airports hasn't improved, has it? Because we're still taking our clothes off.
That's true.
To get on a plane. And it puts me off traveling even on holiday because I don't want to be queuing up, take my belt off, my shoes off, queues go on forever. And, yeah, the joy has been taken out of it, hasn't it? Of travel. I noticed the downturn in 2001. The world has changed unbelievably, but magic wise, there seems to be like an overdose of not very good magic or tricks being crammed out on the market, you know, constantly since those days. I don't know whether it's just because accessibility of YouTube and Facebook and all these platforms that everybody's creating something and everybody seems to be getting involved in it. I don't know.
Yeah. Do you think perhaps then, Paul, let's discuss that a little bit about it could be a lack of knowledge. In other words, some of these people who are YouTubers and are TikTok and creating things don't have a knowledge in the basics or history of what has gone before or what has created. They're going to say, hey, look at this. Well, it's just another double lift, you know, or it's a top palm or whatever. It's different, but they think they are creating something new. Do you think that that might be in part why that we're seeing proliferation of?
Yeah, when I first started in magic, this is the 1960s when I started, but as a teenager in the 70s, part of the enjoyment I thought of magic was the searching and the researching and the discovery of magic, you know, the discovery.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But for my case, probably the same as you, you know, you would be bought a magic set for as a boy for Christmas, and then you'd make your way to the local library and you'd go through the same old 10 magic books on the library, which was probably Henry Hay and a couple of Hoffman books and so on, Royal Road, and then you'd have to find out more, and then you'd find a club, and then the people in the club would teach you the history of magic, and there was a very long journey, and I think that's why people from our generation per se are probably more knowledgeable and probably more well-versed in it than the younger people who can go to YouTube and within 5 seconds, they've got a business card as a magician. You know?
Yeah. I know what you mean.
I'm not putting a rap on these people because it makes me sound like an old fart mm-hmm. by saying that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I still think one should kind of
pay their dues.
I'll give you an example. I think yesterday I looked on Facebook and there's one of these magic groups and you get the same old questions. I've got a gig on Saturday. what trick should I do? I mean, it's dismal, isn't it? It's a dismal comment. Or can somebody tell me where to find this? Where do I find that? What's the best this? What's the best that? And I think, say things like, you know, what suits me won't suit you. What suits you won't suit me. So you need to do your own research. But as soon as I start saying things like that, I come over as a sort of a crotchety old guy who isn't with the times.
You know, what questions you don't hear or read on those kinds of forums is, which tie do you think I should wear for this gig? Should it be a blue or a red tie? And what cologne should I use? And in particular, what kind of bath soap do you recommend? That
that's true. It's funny. But that's actually, that would be funny to post that. I should post that next week. I'll go, I've got my very first gig this Saturday, and I really need to know what socks to wear.
Yeah. Exactly.
I think that's funny.
Yeah. But when it comes down to creating, you have a very good point, Paul. There are so many different, I wouldn't say, well, there are creators who got stuff coming out, but I'm trying to say the jobbers and the wholesalers, let's say, you know, Penguin and Murphy's and Theory 11 and Illusionists and everybody else. And then you got independent people, Jay Sankey and others who are coming out with new things all the time and sending you stuff. But it seems they have just an unending supply weekly of two or three new things that seem to come up all the time, and I'm sure they vet them, which is really kind of a sad thing to think that there are a lot of things that they're not bringing into market that's trash, somebody thinks is good enough that, hey, this, you should be marketing this.
Yeah.
But there still seems to be, as you say, a lot of stuff that is coming to market. I'm sure that's the same way, like over there with Abracadabra and gosh, I'm trying to think of some of the other companies there, and Big Blind Media and everybody in the UK.
Oh,
probably got a ton of stuff coming up from those guys all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I come up with a ton of stuff, but most of my magic goes into my books.
Do you try this out first? In other words, they're just not pipe dreams. Because I read that from time to time, saying these are commercial tricks, not pipe dreams. And then sometimes when they don't say that, it's like, I wonder if that really is just an idea he thought of and jotted it down. But I'm confident, knowing you, being the professional you are, that you have worked out all the details and everything. So once it's released, by golly, this is a worker.
I promise you, that's absolutely the truth. I set that as a goal for myself. I didn't want to release anything that was a pipe dream because. You know, probably same as you. I don't know. Lots of people, I used to read magic books, magic books from the 70s and 80s. And I remember reading sometimes thinking, this trick that this guy has created, I'm sure works very well in theory in his bedroom, but this will never work in the real world of magic or entertainment for 101 reasons. You know, even little things like the guy says, spread the deck face up on the table whilst you're entertaining. And remember the first, 8th, 9th, 16th, and 43rd card. Well, you know. So it's things like that. So I've always set a goal for myself that everything that I've ever created or put in a book or marketed tricks, that they have to be doable, you know.
By what level of person? I mean, like a beginner, intermediate, professional, or all?
Anybody. Doable for a beginner, but doable for a professional. You know, it's like... Again, I remember, these are examples of bad tricks or tricks that I know and you know would never work in the real world. I remember one as a boy, and the guy says, hold the 5-card packet, place it on the table, and the audience will always assume that's just one card. No, right. They won't. You know, 2 cards, you can put a double on the table and somebody will think it's a single card. Maybe, but 5 cards doesn't look like 1 card. And I remember there was a packet trick years ago. And to make the packet trick work, there were 12 cards in it. And those 12 cards were supposed to look like 4 cards.
Well, okay. Well, think about who perhaps is the audience for those particular tricks. They could be for other YouTubers and people who are looking at a two-dimensional plane. If you have a camera down on that card, they can't see the thickness of it necessarily. You know what I'm saying?
I'm talking of this. I'm going back to the 70s and 80s.
Oh, well, sorry. Yep, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Pardon. So, you know, so that kind of thing kind of always annoys me. I mean, you know, Again, when I write my books, I don't want people to flick through thinking, I can't do that, and I can't do that, and I can't do that, and I can't do that, which is what sometimes I've done when I thought, this is totally impractical. Mm-hmm. This won't work for whatever reason, you know.
Well, you do remind me a lot of the creative mind, really, of Paul Cummins, you know, late great friend of both of ours, who was just a great card guy and a good thinker. And, you know,
yeah,
a lot of things that you present also are things that are not necessarily packet tricks, although that I know on your website, you've got a whole list of, you know, packet tricks. And so you got something for everybody, you know, basically. But
my books are mostly regular deck things. With regular slides. So I don't do any second deals or bottom deals. I don't do weird passes and swivel out moves or God knows what else. You know, it's mainly standard moves, you know, from jog shuffles to one hand top palm, a few false counts. And
well, a gambler would never use those kinds of devices, would they?
No.
You know, to call attention to what they could do, it's like, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah, yes. What I say to people is, you know, I post a lot of videos on the internet, mm-hmm. Of tricks. In actual fact, I've filmed nearly all of the things I've published, which is over 1,000 tricks.
Wow.
I film them all and I post them on my website or on Facebook. And I say, look, there's no editing in these videos. What you see is what you get. So I don't do any of that as well. So I want people to feel that they're looking at an honest video of the trick. I mean, sometimes people can backtrack it and that stops them buying the books maybe, but I don't want to deceive my customers by buying a trick. And then when they read the book or they buy the trick, they go, oh, you know, I'm disappointed. I don't want mm-hmm. them to do that.
So do you run these by a brain trust, a group of people or a particular person or somebody to see what they think about that before you actually print the book?
Well, when I was gigging, I did them at the gigs, you know, I would do them at the gigs and then sometimes it didn't work. You know, sometimes I thought something was really good and it didn't work or it didn't play well. And sometimes I've done it for friends and family or in the restaurant where I go or a cafe. I'm quite good at saying to people, what I tend to do is I sit there shuffling a pack of cards and somebody says, what are you doing? Well, that's all I can come and show you if you don't mind. So I clear away their coffee cups and sit down and start chatting and end up doing like a half hour set surrounded by the customers of the cafe. I quite like doing that thing. It's, you know, it's a nice, you know, I used to watch Harry Lorraine do that, you know, when I was younger.
Mm-hmm. Yes. When you were watching Harry, were you over in New York City or was he visiting over in London? Where did you get to know him?
Both. I saw him, I'd tell you a little, as Harry would say, I'll tell you a vignette, back in the late 70s, I think it was. I wanted to see all the greats that I liked, you know, I'd read about. And I'll be honest with you, a lot of them disappointed me because they didn't seem to be able to entertain people with the stuff they created. And it made me almost want to give up magic. And then my father said, let's go to this magic convention. I don't remember what it was in America. And Harry Lorraine was there. And I'd already owned a couple of his books by then. And I saw him in the corner of the bar, surrounded by probably 200 people at this convention. And everybody was laughing and smiling and joking. And he was full of energy. Mm-hmm. And I was standing there thinking, that's what I want to do. I want to be able to get a group of people with a borrowed pack of cards and have them laughing and having a thoroughly good time. And then we became friends. I used to subscribe to and contribute to Apocalypse
magazine. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And some of his books. So he's got some of my magic in his books. And then we became firm friends. And last time I saw him was at his 90th birthday, by the way. I came over to New York to... I can't remember the name, the deli restaurant in the middle of New York. And I flew over, came to see him for a couple of hours and flew straight back home again.
I think I saw your photo published someplace along with him for that. And I may have published that because whenever I did a podcast episode with him. I think he was 92 at the time, I believe. No.
Right.
Around that time, I believe. And he was talking about that, about how many people who had come over, and he appreciated people showing up from overseas like you and other things. You know, that was, I know, very special time.
Was nice. I mean, he was such a hero to me. And I remember saying to him, I said, you know, Harry, and I mean this absolutely sincerely, Scott, not enough people thank their mentors or heroes or the people who inspire them. And I said to Harry, I said, the truth is that if it wasn't for you, Harry, I wouldn't be living in a very nice house with a very nice garden, with the lifestyle I have, et cetera, et cetera. I said, I'm not boasting, Harry, but I would not be doing what I am doing if it wasn't for you.
Mm-hmm.
Reading your books and meeting you and being inspired by you enabled me to get out of the hole of shyness and loneliness when I was a teenager and become an entertainer, earning good money, and a creator and an author and all the other things that have come with it. So I said to him, I literally owe my life and lifestyle to you, Harry, and which is true.
You got a very good point. I don't think that we do give those kinds of kudos to our mentors or people who have inspired us. And sometimes we don't have the opportunity to necessarily thank them. It could be someone, for an example, who's been inspired by Juan Tamariz's books, but who have never met him, for an example.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to try to tell them that. But I think it is important when you do get a chance to see someone who has inspired you to thank them for that, certainly. And I know Harry was has always been such a very nice guy. I remember when, going back to the 4F one time, when he was the guest of honor and he was giving a lecture, and it was going on for so long. And I was sitting in the front row, and I had a cassette player, you know, remember those, sitting on a table, and I was recording his lecture, and it popped up. And so he stopped mid sentence and he looked at me and he said, I'll wait, go ahead and flip it over. And I did. And I pushed the button. He said, ready? And I said, yeah, I'll go. I recorded some more. And of course he went on until like 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning or something. You know, he just was a machine gun. When you were talking about being inspired by him, when you see 100 people around him, it's easy to be inspired by someone saying, hey, look at the joy that they are giving somebody, bodies, all these people who will take this experience away, will never forget it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I remember I went to see him in London that he was lecturing at, I think it was Ron's day, you know, Ron McMillan's day.
McMillan, sure.
In 1999 it was, and it was in a hotel. I think he started about 11 o'clock at night, you know, this late night lecture. And so halfway through the lecture, there's some clattering in the background.
Hmm.
And Harry turned around and said, "What? You know, what the hell is that clattering?" I said, "It's the waiting staff getting the breakfast ready." Because it was about 5 o'clock in the morning.
They probably looked at his watch and said, oh my goodness, I've been going that long. Yeah. Yeah. He would just be nonstop all the time. Well, he there again was one of these creators who came up with a lot of different ideas that were commercial things that he would put out that were not just pipe dreams. And other things, I mean, including mentalism. I mean, my wife and I did a 2-person mentalism routine. And one of the codes we used was from one of his books. So I'm saying it's just a variety of things that people don't think about. You think of him maybe as being a card guy or someone who has this great memory for names and things like that. But he just did kind of a little bit of everything. And you specialize really in cards, but would you say that you kind of go outside of that as well?
No, I don't. I mean, when I was younger, up until the age of, say, 17 or 18, I dabbled in, you know, coins and ropes and silks and all sorts of things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I just fell in love with the card magic. And at that time, I kind of knew fairly well people like Billy McComb and Alan Shackson. And Billy McComb said to me, not in a particularly nice way, he said, you can't just do card magic. It's not enough to entertain people with. And I thought, that's like a red rag to a bull to me. So I thought, we'll see. And then many, many years later, you know, when I was very successful as a card magic only entertainer for the public, Billy McComb introduced me at a lecture, and I reminded him of that, and then he remembered it and said, actually, yeah, you got me there. And
I stand corrected.
I stand corrected, you know, because it's not the magic we do it. It's us, isn't it? It's what we bring to it. It's the magic is the medium, and it's our personalities and our drive, energy, humor, character, persona that brings the punters in.
Well, think about that for an example, like with Ricky Jay and his 52 assistants, which he was doing a show on Broadway successfully. It was just with that. And Guy Hollingworth had one also, I think, Expert at the Card Table most recently. And then there was, of course, Derek Delgadio that had In and of Itself that he was doing mainly cards. Yeah. And so have you thought about or have you done a one-man show of just cards?
I have, not televised or anything, but
at the Fringe Festival or someplace?
I've worked all those places, but what I've done is, and this is the thing I love mostly over the years, somebody will phone up and say, could I do a sit-down card act for their friends and family or for a corporate thing? So I sit down for 1 hour and I take a pack of cards out and I start with high energy, and by the end of it the energy is even higher. And I'm very proud of the fact in that 1 hour I can get people really, you know, spiced up, and I work very quickly, I probably knock out about 60 or 70 tricks in that 1 hour, you know, really bang bang bang, you know. And if people don't believe me watching, there's loads of clips of me on YouTube doing that, you know, where I'm hammer and tongs. That's the kind of the way I kind of bulldozing my way through my act, you know. And that's the most rewarding thing, because to meet, say, 50 strangers who are all very quiet, and 1 hour later you've got them absolutely gripped. It's a wonderful thing to do, I think.
It really is to move them from, as you say, from a high energy thing to an even higher energy at the end. I'm just thinking, for an example, Richard Turner, that I've seen so many times doing his one man show, and it's just unbelievable from the start to the finish. And Juan Tamara's being another one. Danny D'Ortiz, it just keeps it at such a high level. It's like, oh my gosh, it seems like I want to go home and just lay down. I'm tired just watching. It's so so energetic, you know.
Yeah, I think. The other thing is that when I've lectured, mainly the ones in America, I came over for Penguin Live many years ago and did a lecture for Penguin Live, and we'll say four Fs and Tannen. I did Tannen's Jubilee in 1997.
Wow.
Up in Catskill Mountains in New York, and always the booker, whether it be Tony Spina or Obie O'Brien or whoever, they say, we need to know what you're going to do, what your act is, you know, what the set will be. And I say, I don't have an act. It's just me winging my way through my magic, depending on the reaction of the audience and what they say or what they don't say. So, for instance, somebody mutters or calls out, hey, I wouldn't want to play cards with you.
Sure.
Then do one of my poker tricks.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen so-and-so on TV? He reads minds. I'll then do a sort of pseudo mind reading trick, you know. So I've never actually put pen to paper as to what routines I'm going to do. I start in a place of knowledge and I then wing it depending on, you know, where it goes.
So you really consider yourself a jazz magician?
Yeah, which is like the music, isn't it? You know, it's like...
you go where the music or the magic takes you.
Yeah. Yeah, well, this is why, you know, over the years, and I'm not being detrimental to people, but I've often disagreed with lots of theory books that say you must do this, you must do that, you have to do this, you have to do that. And I often read these books thinking, well, actually, I don't do any of that, but I'm doing all right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's not a one fits all solution, is there? You know, we all have a different sort of way of doing it.
I would imagine it's kind of like telling jokes where some joke leads to another, and you understand that the audience likes this particular type of humor, so I'll tell you another joke like that. So the same things, like if you like that card trick, then maybe I can do this. And so it kind of leads down this path, I guess,
I mean, for example, can you imagine if you went out to an audience of 40, 50 people and you said, does anybody here play card games at all? And they all say, no, none of us do. None of us do. And then because your act is set, you end up doing 30 poker tricks, which means nothing to anybody because they
exactly
play cards.
Right.
So I always think along those lines, you know, I'm not going to do things that probably won't mean much to them. So I have to kind of, you know, I did the Harry Lorraine course, you know, like yourself, I did it. I learned his memory system. So I can remember, I've got a good brain for all my tricks, my little finding system of routines.
Mm-hmm.
Mind you, it's getting not so good as I get older, but you know, when I was younger, I could remember much more.
And now a word from our sponsor, the IBM Convention.
The IBM Convention 2024 in Tacoma, Washington is going to be coming up July the 10th through the 13th. And I've got with me right now the chairman of the marketing for the convention, Mr. Jason Michaels. Hey there, Jason.
Hey, Scott. Very excited about this upcoming convention. We have so many cool things scheduled. I mean, there's some talent that I've never heard of that are just doing some cool magic. And I'm so excited to see some of these guys. Like, for instance, Noah Soni. I've never met Noah. Don't know Noah. But Noah's doing an early bird lecture on Tuesday evening. And I can't wait because apparently Noah has a really unique approach to magic. We've got Leah Orleans doing a lecture on marketing and magic. Eric Tate, I mean, FISM champion, one of the winners of FISM recently. He's going to do an inspiration session for us, and he's going to be jamming like each night. I was talking to him, and he said, "I'm so excited to meet people and just hang out and jam on magic." Michael Amar is doing his one man show. Trent James, if people don't know Trent James is one of the most likable young magicians, really super talented. He's doing a lecture. Sean Farquhar is debuting his movie Lost in the Shuffle, which is super cool. We're getting to screen it.
Wow.
You know, I think that's amazing. And of course, we have our close-up contest. We have our stage contest. We have the Lance Burtentine Seminar, which is going on, which, by the way, if you're a youth, it's free to you. If you want to go, you can go to this for free. It's unbelievable. And I mean, there's so many cool things. There's some up-and-coming magicians like Hennock, and then we've got some folks like Michael Vincent that are going to be there. I couldn't be more excited, Scott. This is going to be an amazing convention.
Wow, it really sounds like just not only a top-notch lineup, but also just the things they're going to be doing while they're there. Some of the people that you had mentioned, I don't know quite as well then either, but I'm sure there are going to be some lectures that people will say, did you hear that? And you should have, and you don't want to miss out on that.
Absolutely. I think people are going to be talking about the amazing Bibbick's Bar Magic lecture, too. I think that's one of those hidden gems that people are going to love.
Oh, man, I didn't know Bibbick is going to be lecturing. I love that guy. And yeah, he is the king up there. Seems like that he doesn't get out of Chicago very often because he's always there at the lounge.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Well, he's going to join us in Tacoma.
How great is that? So if people want to register for the convention and also have links to the hotel, where do they go?
Best place to go is ibmconvention.com. All the details, all the schedule, all the talent, everything you can expect is there. And you can also click on a link to register.
That sounds great. Thanks very much, Jason. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
We'll see you in Tacoma.
And now back to our conversation with Paul Gordon.
Actually, this was in America. I did some magic. It was a magic club in America, and the actual club room was inside some kind of modern church building, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing my lecture. The back doors opened, and this porter or
deacon,
I don't know, whatever, from the church, stormed in and said, "We won't have gambling in the house of the Lord." Well, I presume that this club met in there on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And I can't have been the only card magician to be lecturing there. It was a very strange situation. Yeah, yeah. Would you like a funny story?
Yeah.
Well, I say, I've got loads of funny stories.
I want to hear them. Tell me all of them.
It is one. The very first lecture I ever did, 1987, 1980, nearly 40 years ago, the first lecture I did, and 20 people in this club room or so. And it was an old guy, a very old guy in his 90s on the front row. And, you know, he's like this, he's sort of sitting there watching like this. And as I was lecturing, because I always have my front row about 3 foot away, I want them to be proper close up, you know? I looked at him and I, in my head, I thought to myself, he's dead.
Oh no. Oh no.
Died, you know? And I didn't know I had to make an instant judgment as to what to say and how to handle it.
Sure.
So I just stopped my magic and I looked at the club secretary and I said, I think we've got an instant here. Your friend on the front row. And they looked round and sure enough, the guy had died. And they,
oh my gosh.
So cut a long story short, we all, pulled back. They phoned the ambulance. The ambulance came and it was very sad. And they took this poor chap away. And I packed all my magic up, my case, and very somber. Everybody was very upset. And there was a couple of guys at the back crying because they were friends of his. And I said to the club secretary, I said, this is a very, you know, sad, tragic way to, you know, end an evening. But I said, you know, I'm sure he was in his 90s and so on and so forth. And anyway, I said, I will be on my way and leave you to your sadness. He said, what do you mean on your way? You haven't finished your act yet. He said, we've got another hour yet.
The show must go on.
So I unpacked all my bits and pieces and carried on my lecture for the rest of the time, which was very strange indeed.
Well, now that's
it. Dark humor.
Yeah.
That's dreadful, isn't it?
Yes. Well, you said you have some other stories. Is there anything else that comes to mind?
Oh, goodness me. There's so many. You'd have to kind of say something to kind of start me on a story. It's
What about in taping? Whenever you've gone, let's say you're working with Penguin or with Murphy's or Big Blind or somebody when you're doing a DVD and or something, and then you're going to say, wait a minute, this just didn't work and let's do a retake. And so let's reset the cards, or they didn't react the way that you normally do in a real commercial situation.
Yeah. Well, I remember I did a big DVD set for Alakazam called Gold. One of my books is called Gold Dust, and I did a 3 DVD set with 50 routines on it. And I kind of like to, I don't want to do retakes. I like to rehearse my magic so well that I can just do it. And sure. I don't want to be hanging around and I want to do it and get on with things, you know. So we did this whole DVD set in one day from the early morning to the end of the evening. I did 50 routines plus the explanations. And that's a heck of a lot of work, 50 routines for 3 DVD set. And if you look at it on disc one, I'm kind of, hello, everybody.
Perky. Uh-huh.
Disc three, I've kind of got this shadow appeared. And there's a different sort of kind of look about me that says, can I go home yet? You know,
kind of tired, more serious. Yeah.
Yeah. In retrospect, I should have probably done it over a couple of days or something like that. Which is and the other thing is I don't like all this business of asking the audience to laugh or smile or over rehearse them. I don't like all that. It's like the curse of L&L videos, isn't it?
Well, you've just taken the words out of my mouth. I was just about to talk about L&L. When I was working with Banachek and we had done an L&L video, they were over the top. The audience was over the top. They were not a realistic audience. And they asked me to do something before I introduced Banachek, and I performed something. And I've done this in corporate shows and on trade shows and whatever. It's a great trick that I had come up with. But I've never had the reaction there. It was one of those things like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. You know, it's like that just was over the top, but I was warming them up, if you will, getting them ready to, and here's Banachek. He's going to do some amazing stuff. And they just went even crazier over him. So I don't know. I mean, it was way early in the morning. They couldn't have been on drugs that early in the morning, but it seems like they were just all hyped up and hopped up.
And the trouble with that is that everybody knows that it's not a real reaction.
Yeah.
And as soon as you realize it's not a real reaction, you realize that the audience have been prepped beforehand to raise the level. Because most people will applaud by going, oh, that's incredible, that's amazing, or wow, or fantastic. They don't go, ah! You know. And as soon as they do, I said to them when we did the Alakazam, we did get some great responses, but they were regular reactions. And when I did Penguin Live, it was a great response, but at least they were regular reactions, you know. One of my jokes I told at Penguin, which you could hear people kind of, where the hell is he going with this joke, you know?
Yeah.
And so I could see the directors or whatever, because it was live, you know, on the side thinking, what's he saying? Do you want to hear it? Can I tell you the joke?
Yeah, yeah, sure. I want to hear it.
It's about this married couple, and they want to start a family. And they're having no joy at all, no success at all starting a family. So the guy goes to the doctor and says, doctor, we've been trying to start a family. No, nothing's happening. So the doctor says, well, look, take this little jar home, do the business into the jar, bring it back tomorrow, we'll do some tests and we'll see what the problem is. So the guy goes back the next day and puts an empty jar on the doctor's desk. And the doctor says, you haven't filled the jar. And the guy says, well, look, I tried desperately with my right hand, no joy at all. I tried feverishly with my left hand. My wife tried with her left and right hand. We got the mother-in-law involved. She tried with her teeth in, she tried with her teeth out, but none of us could get the lid off the bloody jar. So I told that at Penguin, and I could see these people backstage kind of, oh God, what's he going to say?
Where's he going with this? Yeah.
This thing.
Well, I was actually at a big corporate meeting one time in which the CEO was going to be talking about what they were planning for the coming year and everything. And there were several hundred people in the audience, men and women, business people. And this guy started out for the joke and he said, well, so I'll see if I can make this brief. So the guy went in to, for his annual checkup. Doc said, he's fine. He said, anything that, that I need to know. And he said, well, it's kind of personal. He said, well, I'm your doctor. I'd be glad to help with whatever. So the guy says, well, yeah. He said, whenever I make love to my wife, the first time I get hot and sweaty. And he's kind of saying, okay, yeah, I understand. And then the second time, and the doctor raises eyebrows and he said, I'm kind of cold and clammy. And he said, well, that's kind of unusual. I'll have to think about that and do some research. Well, a few weeks later, this guy's wife had come in for her annual checkup. Everything's fine with her. And he asks again if there's anything perhaps that she wants to share with him. And she said, no, everything's fine. He said, well, I normally don't discuss other patients, but since this is your husband, he had mentioned something. And so maybe you can help clear this up. He told me that when the two of you make love, he gets hot and sweaty. And then the second time, he's cold and clammy. And of course, everybody in the audience is just going, where's he going with this joke, you know? And the lady smiles and said, yeah, I understand. I can explain that. And he said, well, tell me. He said, well, the first time we do it is in July. And then next time is in December. Second time.
That's very good. Very good. I like those kind of jokes. They're kind of, where the hell's this going?
Yes.
I remember, were you a big fan of Foster Brooks?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Plus, he was a great singer. Yes, of course.
Wasn't he? Foster Brooks, absolutely. I mean, nobody these days remembers Foster Brooks, do they? But
yeah, he was the inebriated comedian, singer. What a great guy.
But I just love him. I mean, I love, apart from our English comedians, I'm a big fan of Don Rickles,
mm-hmm.
but Foster Brooks as well. And I remember Foster Brooks telling this story about the guy's, walks through the graveyard some way, he's on his way home, and the vicar's there standing, and the vicar's crying his eyes out. And says, what's the matter, vicar? He said, well, somebody's stolen my bike. I had my bike here, somebody's stolen it. Unbelievable, who would do that to a vicar? And the guy says, well, the way to find out is, he says, when you do your sermon on Sunday, run through the Ten Commandments, and when you get to thou shalt not steal, look around the congregation, you'll see somebody looking a little shifty, and then you'll know who it is. And the vicar says, what a wonderful idea. So comes the Sunday, he goes through the Ten Commandments, but he doesn't stress anything. And afterwards, the guy says to him, I thought, vicar, you were going to stress about thou shalt not steal. And the vicar says, well, I was going to, but he said, when I got to the section about committing adultery, I remembered where I left my bike.
Didn't see that one coming either.
Imagine Foster Brooks doing that as a drunk.
Yes, I could hear him, you know, belching and trying to get through that. It would be so funny. Well, we could tell jokes the rest of the morning over here or afternoon. But I do want to get back over to some of the creativity and some of the ideas and things that you have put out. And when I look at the website, that you have so many things that you have put out. Is there something perhaps that would have been harder for you to have created that is really kind of your baby, that it's like, oh, man, this is great. It may not be a bestseller, but I love this particular thing. And then also, is there something that is a bestseller that everybody's got?
That's an interesting one. My books are my bestsellers. They sell very, very well. And of course, each book is full of doable, practical tricks, if I say so myself. And I've had some very nice comments from people like Jeff McBride and Richard Sanders, Boris Wilde, and all sorts of people about them, because I write in a very conversational manner. And so I'm very proud of the books. And as for the packet tricks, I've never released anything that is kind of not as good as something else, but some of them are a bit more obscure and they probably sell in their hundreds.
Well, the market decides what they want, obviously.
Well, yeah. I mean, because I quite like bizarre tricks, you know, for the bizarre market. I've created quite a few bizarre type tricks, but not many people buy them. But, you know, they are enjoyable to those that do, I hope. But sales-wise, the corner of Piccadilly has been, I mean, I'm not boasting here, but it's probably sold in 30-odd years, it's probably sold 10,000 copies. And that's a heck of a lot of copies of a trick,
right?
Because it's been re-released nearly every year. I re-release it, and in the last 25 years, Murphy's Magic has wholesaled it. I was one of their first customers, by the way, Murphy's Magic, back in the day when Mark Murphy rang me up and said, I'm starting this new business up.
I believe you and I both were, same with the Banachek. That was our early projects. We had done Psychokinetic Silverware VHS with them, and then publishing the Psychological Subtleties, and they have always been a jobber. And so, when Mark was still with Maxwell, and they were just breaking off into Murphy. So, yeah, I guess we're one of the both of us were early into that.
97, 98, was that something like that? I think it is about 97, 98.
Could be. Banachek and I have been partners since 87, so that could be. Maybe it might have been 10 years later, might be in 97.
Yeah. Have I answered your question now? I'm not too sure whether I have.
No.
I haven't.
You were just talking about how that as far as they have sold over 10,000 of those books of yours.
Corner Piccadilly, the trick. Yeah, yes. Yeah. That is not only.
It's not a book. It's a trick. It's a packet trick.
Packet trick. It's a very popular trick, and lots of big pros use it. And I'm very proud of it. It's a very strong trick using aged looking cards, tarot size or slightly bigger. So that's probably one of the things I'm most proud of.
When you are creating things, what do you consider as a muse? Is there something in which that you have perhaps just been listening to music, watching TV, you have a dream in the middle of the night and jot down an idea, or you have been working on something and say, hey, what if I did this instead of that? I mean, there are so many, or it could be all the above then as well. I mean, there's no one thing necessarily that a creator says, this is the way I create. But is there something that you could recommend to others of the muse they should listen to internally in order to create things?
Yeah, I mean, like you say, there's not one thing or the other, but I think mostly I'm tinkering, and I think, what if I did this? What if I did that? Could I do this? Could I do that? And I like tinkering with principles in card magic, ones that aren't often used. For instance, there's a trick of mine in Card Foolers called Killer for the Closer. It's such a strong principle, in my opinion. It's not my principle. The original principle goes back. It's the Ramesses principle that Larry Becker used for will the cards match? Mm-hmm. But I've turned it all up on its head for this particular trick, and I'm just about to release a packet trick version of it for use in pubs and clubs and restaurants using alcoholic drinks and their mixers. So that's using a principle where I've brainstormed a principle and come up with an idea and worked it and so on and so forth.
To put a presentation around it.
Yeah, and also change the principle really as well. Turned it up in its head, really. You'd have to see it to know what I'm talking about, really, I guess. But and sometimes I think probably like we all do, you read something and I think, well, that doesn't need a full deck setup, or it doesn't need that fake card, or maybe I could do it with a borrowed deck, or maybe I could do it without the setup. So there's that kind of process, isn't there?
Well, also your audience will tell you as well, if you're starting to do something and you're doing a pack a trick with 9 cards that could easily be done with 6 cards, then why not whittle it down? Because you're just making it too long that the outcome is still the same as far as the appreciation for the trick. You might as well cut out the other 30 cards, that kind of a thing. And so it's from actually being in the trenches and doing the tricks.
Yeah, yeah. But it's also, there was a trick, I can't remember the name of the trick. In one of my books, I released a trick called Twister back in the 90s in a book of mine called Nocturnal Creations. And it was taking a fairly well-known trick that used 7 cards to pass off as 4. And I came up with exactly the same trick without any changes to the effect, but using 5 cards. And I think it was important because 7 cards look like a fat packet, whereas 5 cards looks like 4. And I think that was a very good bonus because the cards could be easily displayed and handled and without any suspicion close up, you know.
Yeah, right.
So there's that kind of a thing. And the diary trick of mine, the Gordon diary trick.
Oh, yeah. You are well known for that trick as well.
Yeah. And it's the only, well, it was the only totally impromptu version of it with a regular diary, which you could make up yourself with all different cards in it.
Explain the effect for people who are oblivious to what the heck we're talking about here.
Yeah. The diary trick. Well, just to go back further, the diary trick is the creation of Ted Danson. In the 1950s, an English performer who was friends with Alex Elmsley and Roy Walton, John Derris, and so on. And the diary trick is you have a diary instead of events that you're going to do. You on all the dates in the year, you have a name of a playing card. And of course, there's 52 cards in the deck, so they are repeated, you know, a few times throughout the diary. But anyway, you show the diary with all the dates on it,
right?
And with all the playing cards entries, you then hand the spectator the diary. And in my case, with my trick, with one pack of cards, borrowed pack of cards, you ask the spectator to shuffle the cards. You ask them to name a particular date in the year that means something to them. And then you ask them to choose a card. So let's assume that they choose the 5 of clubs and the date they choose is the 24th of December. They turn to the date and in the date in the diary is the same card they just chose.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the effect. But my method is using one regular diary, which can be inspected, one pack of cards, which is borrowed, and they shuffle the pack at the beginning. I'm not going to tell you any more than that.
No, I bought the trick many years ago.
You got it.
Yeah. I haven't done it in a while. I mean, I've moved, it's here someplace, but it was one of those things that I've always enjoyed that trick, and I had made up a diary and, you know, gone through all the process from the original the way that it was. And then when I heard about yours, it's like, I got to get that. And when I was working restaurants, I would do that. That is just a killer trick.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say so. Alex, Alan Shaxson used to use it in his stage act.
Mm-hmm.
Kyne Horn uses it in his act as well. There's a system, obviously, as you know,
just
people listening or watching. But it's one of the easier methods out there and the most practical method, I think.
I think the idea is more practical than just about anything because the David Berglass card at any number plot or scenario is well known, but this makes perfect sense. The people are used to a diary or a calendar, as we call it in the U.S., which is just like a pocket calendar that fits into your breast pocket or something. It's that type of a thing for people who are wondering about what kind of a diary you're talking about in the U.S. But anyhow, by having that, it makes more sense. And then by relating cards to a date that could be their birthday or whatever else. Since I just love the idea. It takes it to a different level.
It's a lovely, lovely plot, isn't it? I remember when I came up with it, I was researching other methods. And so I bought lots of other methods that were on the market at the time. And one of them, this big box arrived like this. And when I took it out, there were 7 diaries in it. And it said, in the instructions, secrete these 7 diaries amongst your person.
In different parts of your,
I don't think I've even got 7 pockets, let alone, breast pocket, inner breast pocket, trouser pocket, left trouser pocket, back pocket, jacket pocket. I mean, you'd end up being look like the Michelin man, wouldn't you?
That's right. That's pretty true. Pretty true. Well, Paul, this has been great. I enjoyed the chance we've had to sit and chat. You can get caught up here for a while. It's been lovely. Tell me, the name of my podcast, of course, is called The Magic Word Podcast. And so I always like to close by asking my guests what it is that your philosophy of life, what is it's important to you? It doesn't have to be a word. It can be a phrase or, what's your phrase?
What's my, you got me there as well. I don't know. God, what's my phrase? I can remember, I'll tell you, this is one I remember I saw Frank Sinatra say once. He used to say, if I get this right now, you've got me on the hop here. If you want to be seen, stand up. If you want to be heard, speak up. But if you want to be loved, shut up and sit down.
Wow. I've never heard that one before.
Or his other one was, and may you live to be 100 years old, and the last card trick you see or read is one of mine.
There you go.
How about that?
That's good. Paul, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Scott. I hope if you ever want to chat again with even more funny stories, whatever, it'd be lovely to do it.
Yep. Love the chat. And I know we'll be seeing each other somewhere down the road somewhere soon, I'm sure.
Thank you. And lots of love to everybody watching. Bless you all. And may you all live to be 100 years old. And the last card trick you try or read is one of mine.
That's great. And if you want to, go to paulgordon.com and you can see about getting this book. .net.
Paulgordon.net. If you go to paulgordon.com, I think you get a hairdresser.
Oh, completely different guy. He doesn't do the kind of magic you do. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that's Paul Gordon. This is Scotty out. Thank you very much, Paul, for your time and all of your words and advice. Those stories were so funny, and I appreciate an opportunity to have chatting with you over here. And for those of you who might be interested in watching this, actually, we did record this on a Zoom video, and there were a few extra stories that were on the video that we had edited out just for time on the podcast here. But if you want to see the full uncut part of our conversation, you can go to YouTube and you can view it there, or just go to themagicwordpodcast.com and there is a link to that YouTube video then as well. So again, thank you very much, Paul. I appreciate it. And also I wanted to remind everybody to go to ibmconvention.com where you could sign up then for the convention, which is coming up just right around the corner. It starts on July the 10th and goes through the 13th in Tacoma, Washington. Again, ibmconvention.com. Go check it out. And also I want to thank and say happy birthday to my friend Bruce Leash. And in fact, I said I had something that was a bit of a surprise. And so here it is.
Hello, folks. It's Paul Gordon here, and a very special birthday wish to Bruce, who's 55 today. And without any band whatsoever, I'd like to say happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Bruce. Happy birthday to you and many more.
How cool is that? I mean, after just talking with Paul Gordon and him telling us that he is a professional singer, to have him share that then also, he was glad to do that, especially for you. Thank you, Bruce. And thank the rest of you listeners then as well for tuning in here this week. It's been just a lot of fun. Again, happy birthday, Bruce. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember that if you want to be seen, stand up. If you want to be heard, speak up. If you want to be loved, then shut up and sit down. I think I'll do that right now. This is Scotty out.